Hello and welcome to this week's Realty Talk Show. It's estimated, according to a recent NAB survey, that up to 3.5% of all property purchases in Australia are made with the assistance of a buyer's agent. Now that's about 17,500 every year. Based on USA stats, where buyer's agents are a much more used resource, some say that figure is going to climb to 37%. But just 1 week ago in the US, courts ruled in favour of a group of consumers on a compensation claim worth $415 million that relates to how buyer's agents are paid in that country. Now, that decision, if it gets final approval, is set to turn the commission structure and the selling process in the USA on its head. Already, some industry leaders are looking at the Australian model as a bit of a guide. Time will tell on that issue. It's an important one, and we will keep an eye on it for you. Negative gearing is under attack. I was going to say again, but it'd be more appropriate to say still. Yep, the Greens are at it again, looking at labelling mum and dad investors as the baddies. Rasty joins Bushy to discuss the likelihood that something might actually happen and what the impact will be. Before we get started, we want to thank our supporters and content partners, Realty, BMT Tax Depreciation, Know How Property Finance, Get Rare Property and Apiro Marketing. Hey, if this is your first time with us, welcome. You're going to find us on all podcast players and through the Southern Cross Old Stereo Network. If you like the show, please hit the subscribe button. Help us to continue to bring you the best guests every week. Don't forget too that you can join the conversation anytime on Facebook at the Property Hub Collective. Back in just a moment as we kick off this week's show.
Property deductions can save you thousands of dollars each year. To make sure you maximise deductions, you need to work with the most experienced quantity surveyor in the country. BMT Tax Depreciation is the leading specialist in the industry. They've completed over 700,000 tax deduction schedules for residential investment and commercial properties Australia-wide. BMT guarantee to find double your fee in the first full financial year deductions. Call BMT on 1300 728 726 today for an obligation-free quote.
Realty Talk and your host, Bushy Martin.
How do you select one of the best buyer's agents and proven performers while avoiding the risks that are associated with the rest? Well, the best place to start is with REBA, the Real Estate Buyer's Agent Association of Australia, that only allows the best buyer's agents to become members after a rigorous qualification process and has a strict code of conduct that each of the current 92 members must abide by. So to expand on this and unpack the details of the recent upgrade to the REBA code of conduct that's actually going to help you to engage a buyer's agent that will give you the best possible opportunity to secure the right property for you, we're joined by the REBA president, Melinda Jennison. So welcome back to the show, Melinda.
Thanks again for having me, Bushy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Always. And I know you and I have been talking about this topic a little bit in recent times, but I guess just to get things going on this really important topic, how can property buyers give themselves the best chance to select a good buyer's agent, Melinda?
Oh, look, I think you covered off very well in the introduction some of the alarming things that consumers are faced with within our industry. There's some very good marketing campaigns out there that will sell the story of a great buyer's agency. But I encourage all buyers to do their research, and that includes doing their research on the professional buyer's agent that they're choosing to partner with. And it's really important to understand what is their experience, what is the agent relationships that they hold, or how deep are those relationships in the areas that they buy? And also, what is the level of local knowledge that they carry in the areas that they are looking to represent you in? And of course, there is a way that consumers can feel more confident, and that is by partnering with a REBA accredited buyer's agent.
Yeah, very well said. Now, I'd like you to sort of put some more emphasis around this by sharing any horror stories of property buyers who've actually engaged buyer's agents who weren't REBA members. Have you got any examples?
You know, it's interesting because we speak to property buyers all the time, and we understand the journey that some buyers go on when they're interviewing to partner with a buyer's agent. And recently I had a client who became a client of ours said to us that it's like swimming in a shark tank. Now, it's like swimming in a shark tank to select a buyer's agent, which is a major concern for me personally, but also for REBA as an association group. Now, other stories that I've heard are things like a property buyer might be presented with a property and they're given 2 to 3 hours to make a decision as to whether that is going to be a property that they're wanting to buy. Otherwise, an agency might pass that buyer or property onto another buyer on their list. So larger agencies that have a lot of buyers on their books are known to do these sorts of things, which is completely lacking that ethical conduct in our opinion. I've spoken to buyer's agents who have inquired about REBA membership, who have worked with some agencies that clearly do not abide by the minimum requirements that are in place based on legislation. We've also heard that volume-based buyer's agents will use their own client purchases to drive up the value of specific locations in certain areas. And when they stop buying there, nothing else happens because the local buyers can no longer afford to buy. So these are some of the horror stories that we've heard as an industry association. And certainly they are alarming stories. And it's a reason why we do want to ensure that the consumers have a way to set themselves up for success.
100% agree. Yeah, you've touched on some really salient points there. Are there any other risks of using a buyer's agent who's not a REBA member that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of buyer's agents that are not exclusively working on behalf of the buyer. So there are some sales agents now who are having a dip in the buyer's agent space. So potentially there can be a conflict of interest in that regard. There's also some people that call themselves buyer's agents, but they're actually taking a clip from the developer or a builder in offloading brand new products. Now, that's not a buyer's agent in the terminology that REBA as an association group would use. There's a lot of non-ethical practices out there. And as you've pointed out, there's some training courses that are on offer that really highlight the financial reward that people can gain by becoming a buyer's agent part-time on the side. Now, there's absolutely no way that you can represent a client with the correct level of care and duty required by the role on a part-time basis. So these claims are a concern for us. But we've even got heard of situations where buyer's agents don't hold the required professional indemnity insurance. Now, as a consumer, that's going to put you at risk if anything does become an issue in the future. There's certainly a lot of buyer's agents in the industry that lack local knowledge and they're not using licensed people on the ground to inspect properties, or they're not even inspecting properties themselves. And I would also say there's a lot of buyer's agents that are simply using some automatic valuation tools to price a property instead of getting down to the nitty-gritty and really understanding the value of a property to add value for their clients. So there's a lot of alarming things that happen in our industry that our association group are aware of, and it's certainly nothing that our members would be a part of.
Yeah, a little bit scary, but let's now sort of focus in on REBA, and I'd love you to sort of talk us through what are the minimum requirements that a buyer's agent needs to meet in order to be considered for REBA membership.
Well, that's one thing that we pride ourselves on as a membership group. So we're not a membership body that simply allows members to pay a joining fee and they're in. Instead, members must meet minimum qualifying criteria. Now, with the most recent update to the Code of Conduct, members must be operational in their current business for a minimum of 12 months before they can apply for membership. So we've even had a recent application from a buyer's agent who's been contracting to another larger buyer's agency for many years. Because they've just started out under their own brand, they still need to wait, even though they're actually very good operators. So we do ensure that members have a brand operating for at least 12 months. They've absolutely got to be licensed in every state they're operating in. And we find through some member applications that even some of the bigger companies who have applied, they don't meet that requirement. So they're not even aware sometimes of the licensing requirements in each state, which is very alarming when a lot of these agencies are operating without the adequate licenses. We also have to ensure that the principal and all staff meet those licensing requirements. So it's not just the agency, but it's all staff working within that agency. Professional indemnity insurance is an absolute prerequisite to a minimum value of $2 million. So consumers know that they're going to have that, that to fall back on in a worst case situation, you could say. And also members are not to be involved in any form of direct selling. So they are working exclusively as a buyer's agent. And of course, all members have to abide by our code of conduct. And that's providing a minimum level for professional standards and ethical conduct within the industry.
That's fantastic. Well, there's some certainly pretty stringent hurdles there that need to be jumped over before they can even wear the REBA badge. So apart from what you've already shared with us then, Melinda, what other protections and benefits does a property buyer enjoy by engaging a REBA member?
Look, I think the biggest thing for property buyers to understand is they're going to be partnering with an experienced provider who has runs on the board, and they're going to be ethical in their conduct. So they're acting exclusively for you as the buyer if they are a REBA member. They're going to be adequately insured and licensed, which gives buyers peace of mind knowing that there's not going to be any wrongdoings in the way they operate. But also all members of REBA have access to ongoing training and professional development. And this is critical at a time where the industry really is growing and there's a lot of new operators coming into the industry. We've got members that have been in this space for more than 20 years. So we've got some of the most experienced buyer's agents around the country. And we continue to rely on mentorship from some of our most experienced members, which really does improve the service levels of all of our members. And of course, those the professional code of conduct that our organization abides by, it does give those buyers the peace of mind knowing that they're working with a professional.
Absolutely. Well, given the numbers I mentioned in the intro, where there's, you know, under 100 odd members of REBA, and there's roughly 1,000 odd buyer's agents active in the industry, well, that's telling me straight away that only the best 10% are actually making the grade as far as that goes. So now you've already mentioned the update to the REBA code of conduct. Can you talk to us a bit more about that in terms of the any other minimum expected standards or changes that are going to improve the position of buyers who engage them moving forward?
Yeah, so I was elected as the REBA president in August 2023. And since then, I've been working with the executive committee on the strategic plan and pathway forward for the organisation, because we have recognised that the industry is changing and our organisation is also needing to change in relation to that change in the industry as a whole. So the new code of conduct is designed to maintain minimum standards for effective conduct within the industry, whilst at the same time encouraging the best operators to join and benefit from the operations that REBA has in place. So, of course, the updated code of conduct also requires members to comply with our values as an organisation. It requires all members to continue engaging in professional development over time. All members are required to avoid any misleading or deceptive or dishonest conduct, and that includes in their marketing messages, because we can all agree that some, you know, buyer's agents make their results look very flashy, and that can quite often be misleading for the consumer. Yeah. And all of our members contribute to the ongoing development of other members as well. So any members of REBA really are there to improve industry standards as a whole for those operating in the industry.
Yeah, well said. Now, you've touched on this briefly already, but I noticed on reading the new code of conduct that it stipulates that REBA members need to ensure that the recommended property is actually physically inspected by the buyer's agent or an adequately licensed employee of their company. Now, given the growing number of buyer's agents who, you know, profess to be able to secure properties anywhere, anytime, right across the country nationally, what impact is this likely to have, do you think?
Yeah, look, it's a huge concern of ours, as I pointed out earlier, that there's buyer's agents operating nationally, or even if they're only operating in two or three states, but they're not licensed adequately in each state, or their employees are not holding the relevant licenses within each state. So that's a serious concern for us. And of course, anyone that is inspecting property on behalf of a buyer needs the relevant license in that state. There's some buyer's agents out there who are not even inspecting properties for their clients, but instead they're relying on third parties. Some people are relying on property managers. Now, of course, there's a conflict of interest because the property manager wants to secure the business, so they're not going to provide an independent and unbiased assessment of the property. Some buyer's agents are relying on other third parties who may not even be involved in the property industry. Friends, family, these are the sorts of reports that we've heard. Now, again, that's a major concern. If you're paying a professional to represent you, you do and should demand a level of service that includes a physical inspection that is detailed to help you come to an informed decision. So these are alarming facts, and this is happening in our industry. However, consumers can be assured that if they are partnering with a REBA accredited buyer's agent, that their properties are being inspected by affiliates in the organisation who are licensed to be inspecting those properties and providing unbiased advice around the condition of those properties.
Yeah, I love it. That's certainly going to sort the wheat from the chaff in that regard. And I really like the fact that, as you've shared already, that it's actually difficult to some degree to actually become a REBA member, given the hurdles that they've got to jump to make that happen. Once they become a member, how enforceable is the REBA code of conduct, and what penalties does a buyer's agent incur if they actually breach the code?
It's a great question. And one thing that we're very proud about is enforcement of the code of conduct. So we've included with this updated release a complaints handling process. So that enables consumers to report any alleged breaches of the code of conduct. And members will be investigated if there's an alleged breach. So that the objective is that as an association, we can work with the member to resolve any matter satisfactorily, or alternatively, depending on the extent of the breach, we would have the power to revoke membership. So we take this very seriously, and we, whilst our member group is quite small at this point in time, we want consumers to know that by partnering with a REBA accredited member, they will get the best level of service, because we do have a commitment to excellence and we do expect our members to abide by our code of conduct.
Now, I love the fact that the big swinging blade there is the potential to have your membership revoked, because that's going to speak volumes. The more that people are aware of REBA's place in that, and the more that people who are even contemplating getting a buyer's agent reach out to REBA and check to make sure that people are actually REBA members before they take anything further is really important. But look, to sort of circle back now, given that overall context, and to sort of help those that are wanting to separate the good from the bad in terms of buyer's agents, have you got any thoughts on what questions a property buyer needs to ask to ensure that they are actually engaging a good qualified buyer's agent?
Yeah, it's a good question. And one thing that we talk about with experience, our hashtag is ask for experience. So buyers should always ask for experience and get an understanding of how experienced a buyer's agent is, because we are very aware that with a lot of new entrants, people are charging similar fees to very experienced buyer's agents, but they're not getting the service that they should be expecting. So ask for the experience, ask for local knowledge and understanding of, you know, how well they know the area that they buy and how many agents they have formed relationships with in those local areas. Because as a buyer's agent, one of the benefits that consumers have by partnering with us is to leverage those relationships with sales agents to access opportunities that they may not be able to access themselves. And I would also ask, of course, ask if they're a member of REBA, because I think if the answer to that is yes, a consumer can be assured that the buyer's agent will meet minimum standards, is adequately licensed, holds the adequate insurance, and is going to abide by a professional code of conduct. And therefore, they're going to get the best potential outcome based on their needs.
Yeah, I think having listened to what you've shared with us today, just asking that one question, are you a REBA member? In behind that, given everything that we've talked about, is going to give them that layer of protection. So if it's one thing that needs to be taken away from the discussion today, it's for anyone who's contemplating engaging a buyer's agent to assist them in their property journey, ask that question. Are you a REBA member? Because everything else flows out from the back of that. So look, I really want to thank you again for enlightening us on this really important topic, Melinda. And it's even more clear because I want to reinforce this again, that anyone considering a buyer's agent and they want to work with a proven property professional, you need to ask them if they're a current member of REBA, or just check out the current REBA member directory at reba.com.au/members. That's reba.com.au/members, because that's your most important starting point. So thanks again for all your time on the show today, Melinda.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Are you curious about harnessing your super for property investment? Propel your future with the enlightening online seminar, The Ultimate Masterclass to Self-Managed Superfund Property Mastery. Reserve your spot now at getrare.com.au/SMSF. Spearheaded by Rasti from independent buyer's agency Get Rare Properties, this masterclass unravels strategic property investment using your self-managed superannuation fund. You know, it's not just about learning. It's about transforming your financial future through education. So embrace this opportunity to enrich your investing acumen. Enroll now in the free masterclass and begin a journey that marries insight with action, leading to a financially empowered tomorrow.
Realty Talk from Property Hub on all podcast players.
Now, with the recent softening and modification of the stage four tax cuts by the federal government, the Greens Party, in what I would call their naivety and ill-informed short-sighted ignorance, has again leapt on the desperate opportunity to gain some much-needed media exposure in a sort of a vain attempt to try and justify their existence by blaming so-called greedy mum and dad property investors for the current housing crisis, and is calling for negative gearing to be axed or severely watered down at the very least, along with a raft of other capital gains tax and related tax changes. So to put some objective and well-balanced and well-informed balance back into the debate, and to discuss the potential impacts of the Green suggested measures, we're joined by leading national buyer's agent, Rusty Vipat from Get Rare Property. So welcome back to the show, Rusty.
Thank you so much, Richie. Thank you so much. It's so much relevant what's really going out there. So I'm glad to be here talking about those things going around.
Yeah, I always welcome your words of wisdom on these topics. And this is a bit of an old chestnut that just keeps resurfacing every time a political party's got an opportunity to try and pin the tail on the donkey. And it's got another run. So I guess to jump into that exercise, in the unfortunate event that something was to happen there, how might the removal of negative gearing affect property investment strategies? And as importantly, what alternative approaches could investors consider, do you think?
Sure. So first of all, like, as we appreciate that the whole element around negative gearing is that it actually makes it easy as the holding cost for the taxpayer or for the property buyer. But when we take this off, all of a sudden, like, we are really looking at the losses that we are making on the property to be realized, because there's no such thing that it you can actually offer us. So what is really going to happen is that, in my opinion, is that there will be the negative gearing element, or the reason why people invest in properties with that as an element, will actually go away. Because if negative gearing is taken away, I mean, if that is the reason, then there will be less investment happening because of that. And all of a sudden, the element for which a general property investor should be buying it for is, as you and I know, is a capital growth. So there will be more emphasis given on the capital growth. And what might happen is that there might be some rush of property investors selling of the property because all of a sudden they can't really afford, especially with the interest rate that we've seen going up. So it has really pushed people, as we call it, as a mortgage cliff, that they can't really afford that repayments. And they might say, look, there's not much benefit anyway coming from ATO on the back of the depreciation. So what might happen is that the reason negative gearing is so much in favor and the type of properties which are going around it, for example, new developments, new constructions, because it's very easy for the developers to sell a new property to the investors because they are certainly saying all this kind of a builder's warranty and whatnot. And then on top of it, yes, you're losing money because you are actually able to offset your tax losses. But if we take that off, all of a sudden, there might not be much demand for the new constructions, relatively speaking. So that might really see some element of construction projects not taking off because they might have struggle or they might experience some struggle selling them off. So what we're really saying is that as a strategy, there might be more focus on positive or neutral geared properties, if anything else, then there might be focus for the long-term capital growth, which basically means buying the right property with the strong fundamentals of supply and demand, and also maybe not so much focus on the new properties, but rather on the existing properties, which are in the prime location with a huge demand around it. What we've really seen is that if you look at the surveys from Property Investment Professionals of Australia, as in PIPA, it is indicating that it will be about 10 or 20% of investors might exit the market because of this change happening. And there'll be reduction of the demand by 12 to 15% as per Grattan Institute reports.
Yeah, I think that's very well summed up because I think what some of the current and younger politicians are forgetting is that, you know, sadly or otherwise, I'm old and crusty enough to remember when the current version of negative gearing and CGT was brought in. And one of the key reasons for implementing it was, one, the governments had got out of providing housing, so they needed to incentivize mum and dads to invest in property, not only to provide the ongoing supply, which they now pretty much carry the heavy load on, but also it was a means of actually incentivizing you and I to invest in our future. Because in addition to superannuation, as you and I know, property is a very strong vehicle to actually build that nest egg quite effectively. And that capital gains tax exemption means that people are putting more in their pocket. And then as a result, relying less on the government purse to fund pensions and other social services. So like everything, you've got to look beyond the immediate exercise to look at the ripple effects that flow on from that. But just sort of rolling into that then, what are your thoughts on the projected impacts on housing affordability and the rental market if negative gearing was actually eliminated?
No, great question. So look, I'm a firm believer that when market is left by itself, the demand and supply are the key factors that will really define everything around it. And whenever and wherever they interject, that will define the price point, whether it is for your the purchase price or even for the rental. Now, if you really take a pause on negative gearing, and what we are really talking about is that there will be lots of people exiting out of it, a substantial number as a marginally if you think about it. And as to your point, like if there's not much incentive for moms and dads or regular investors to not to enter in the market, what might happen is that there is the onus of building new properties would really go back to the government.
Yes.
And like I, as an investor, always have felt that we are kind of doing a social or government thing here to provide our elementary services of providing a housing. And if we take that away for, I guess, removing that incentive, that removes that propensity of doing so. So effectively, the reference is that there will be less properties built as a new developments because that was one of the reasons that they were able to sell. If there are less developments happening, and people not able to, I guess, invest into them, all of a sudden there's less rental properties out there. And the demand that we see that there are more people coming in. As an example, what we saw was 480,000 people coming in. Now, they're not really coming from the social geography as an average demography they come from. They're not really going to buy a property within the first month. So they have to start as a tenant. Yeah. And all of a sudden, like at least it takes about 2 to 3 years for them to be ready to buy something on their own. So that means they're starting as a tenant. Now, even for a regular population here, rental is their way of doing things because A, they might not be able to afford a property, or they're probably doing rent vesting, as in living where they can afford to live and they're investing where they can afford to invest. So all of a sudden, there will be the change in the dynamics around that. Less properties for in the market means, I mean, when the supply is less, the demand is huge, the rent will go up. We're really talking about 10 to 15% rental increase from that element alone, just looking at the rental as in the properties decreased by that amount. So it might seem that it is making it affordable, which probably might be the case for the initial period when there will be a lot of people, regular investors who are trying to offload the properties because it's not really making any sense anymore. And the construction, which is really happening, will still complete. So we might see some decrease in the pricing, so actually making it more of an affordable thing. But when it comes to the medium to long term, I think it really goes back to the same thing. The pricing will go up again because the demand is still huge there, and we curtail the supply, the price will go up. Same thing with the rental market. So it might be, as you, to your point, it is not really for the economics as a taxpayer, as a policy that will change everything in the long term. But if you really go back to, you know, the point that you made, like initially in the Hawk government experience, they tried to temporarily seize this negative gearing and capital gain tax, exactly what we are trying to do here, as the Greens are trying to do here. We saw that there was actually an increase in rental market in Sydney and Perth. It was actually stable in Melbourne and Brisbane, and actually it fell down in Adelaide.
Yep.
Now, what it tells us is that it's not about the policy alone. It's about the fundamental supply and demand that will have a bigger play. And if government is listening, Greens are listening to this or looking at this, they really should be looking at the fundamental supply and demand. If at all we need to be making housing affordable, let's talk about policies around making bigger supply in the market.
Absolutely agree. Yeah. Now, turning to the other element of that, and that's the longer term capital gains that we touched on earlier. In what ways do you think the changes to CGT might influence investor behavior, particularly in terms of holding periods for property investments then, Rusty?
No, totally. So look, the capital gain tax, as we know, if you hold the property for more than a year, we get a 50% capital gain tax exemption. And if you take that away, all of a sudden, people might not really have that propensity to sell it immediately. So they might really see the transaction cost, for the transaction, the same transaction might go up. So it would actually lead them to hold the property for longer. So there will be less of speculating investing. So to me, that's really a good objective, I mean, which really serves the market as well as, let the government build up their surplus around it. So what it will do is like it will reduce the speculative investing. People would be thinking about longer holdings. That means they are really thinking a bit more long-term because property should be considered for the long-term.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the same point of like people who were trying to build new construction, new budgets, new developments. And they were really talking about the negative gearing and they were saying, okay, you take the development risk, sell it after 1 or 2, 3 years, you make money and then move out to the other project. So they were speculators among investors who were really taking advantage of. All of a sudden, when that element is taken off, maybe to only an extent, because 50% might not be enough for someone to sway away, but it's still an element. So that would really discourage the short-term investing, speculating investing around it. What it might also do is that all of a sudden, there might be more inclination for people to buy their own home. That might be a factor building up. And then also, there would be more investing under self-managed super fund in properties because that's where the tax regime is a lot more favorable for property investors.
Yeah, I think the challenge there with the super piece is that the rules keep changing in that sphere as well. So the certainty from someone purchasing property in that down the track has some question marks as well. But look, you've touched on a little bit of this already, but how do you think the removal of these tax incentives is likely to affect the supply and demand dynamics within the property market across the country?
So talking about the supply element for when we take the capital gain tax away?
Yeah, so if the negative gearing and the CGT were taken away, what effect would that have on the supply and demand dynamics across the board?
Yeah, no. So what would happen, in my opinion, is that there will be a development slowdown because new developments favor negative gearing as well as short, speculative investing. So that will be discouraged. So I would think that would have a slowdown on that. There would be increase of first home buyer because now they are actually having trouble to find rental properties, and they are really thinking about getting a roof on their head. So there might be some increase over there because they're not really rent investing anymore. They might really say that, okay, let me find my own home. And there will be suddenly some affordability increase to in the beginning years when the transition is happening, because people might be offloading their properties and the construction might still finish of the projects that they have started. So there might be some increase of the properties. That means that there might be some drop in the pricing of the properties, effectively saying that there might be some increased affordability just in the short-term period, but then it will go back to its normal. What we say in economics is the hand of God will come in and will balance out the supply and demand accordingly. So I've always believed that when there is always some sort of incentive given to one or the other, it tends to sway the market, and not an equilibrium. But again, when the market is so much used to that equilibrium, if you take that away, then all of a sudden it will take some time to get back to its equilibrium level. And I would think it will be actually not so good in the long run. To your point, unless government does something on the policies, it should let the home, like mom and dad investors, to really supply the need of housing to average Australian.
Yeah, very well said. And you know, what's obvious is that there, and this is the danger, really, there might be some apparent short-term gain, but the long-term pain that's going to fly out of squeezing supply, which is effectively what that's going to do, could have even worse effects than what the politicians are trying to fix. So, to sort of bring it all to a head then, what could be the sort of broader economic consequences of changing these property tax policies, Rusty, and how might they impact on government revenues and public services?
So what we're really reading is that the Treasury is expecting it to be about $3 billion that they will collect over the next 4 years. But at the same time, the GDP around construction will go down, because when the construction goes down, they might not really get that. So about 1 or 2% potential negative impact on the because of the sector slowdown. But what on the favor, what really will go or might happen is that there will be less volatility in the market. Because when we take away the volatile element or elements, volatile segment of property investing, we take that away, which is a new construction, because we do not know what happens after a new build, whether the price goes up or down, versus a property in a well-established area that really which grows in a systematic, consistent growth. So when the volatility takes away, which will be good for market in general, like financial stability will be there. But at the same time, I would argue that there will be an economic, there's a risk of economic slowdown during the transition when this happens and the new equilibrium is effectively found by the market.
Yeah, no, very well said. Well, look, I want to thank you for taking the time to share these sort of very sage thoughts on what I consider to be the naivety and quite short-sighted impacts and unforeseen consequences of the Greens tax change calls, which are extremely unlikely to actually get any serious attention and consideration for those who really understand what's going on, given Australia's very heavy reliance on property values to underpin national wealth, alongside the fact that mum and dad and property investors are and will continue to be the major provider of housing stock. So any changes would potentially only make things worse rather than better long term. So we encourage anyone wanting to explore property investment strategy options further to reach out to you, Rusty, at getrare.com.au. So thanks again for your valuable time on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, but you really appreciate it.
Successful property investment is a game of finance. Do you have the right team and the right game plan? Realty Talk is brought to you by Know How Property. More than mortgage brokers, Bushy Martin and his team of investment architects set you up with a sustainable strategy structured to lower your costs, tax, risk, and stress while increasing your capacity for growth. KnowHow has helped over 1,900 homeowners and investors secure more than $800 million in property wealth. So get set to live more, work less, and live your legacy. Want to know how to invest in your freedom? Visit knowhowproperty.com.au.
This is Realty Talk, powered by realty.com.au.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Make sure that you don't miss a single episode of Realty Talk or Bushy's Get Invested podcast delivered to you each week. You can do that by subscribing to the Property Hub now on your favorite podcast player or wherever you are listening to or watching this show. Also, join the conversation anytime on Facebook at the Property Hub Collective. Thanks to our supporters and content partners, Realty, BMT Tax Depreciation, KnowHow Property Finance, Get Rare Property and Apiro Marketing. I'm Kevin Turner, and on behalf of Bushy and the Property Hub team, we look forward to seeing you again next week.